the interface between particle physics and astrophysics. And I will not discuss in great detail dark energy, which became fashionable as this interface recently. I think it's a social trend, but not necessarily really merits the attention that it gets, because we pretty much know that W is very close to minus one, within 10% or so. And the fact that I have nevertheless things to say in the remaining part of my talk means that there is much more to discuss on this interface between particle physics and cosmology. So the three topics that I'd like to mention, and I'm not sure I'll get through all the details, depending on how many questions you have, are the following. These are topics, the common theme is that these are topics that are just coming on the horizon now, and that people are not very much aware of, and that over the next decade, I think there will be a lot of activity on. At least that's what I hope, and part of the purpose in discussing them is that to encourage people to work on these topics. So the first one has to do with using a new probe in cosmology, the 21 centimeter line of hydrogen, to map the distribution of matter at early times. And that in principle gives us clues about the initial conditions from inflation, as I will describe, the nature of the dark matter. Basically, both of these involve conditions under extreme environments that we cannot probe directly in the laboratory at the moment. Then the second topic involves supermassive black holes and the possibility of imaging them, and by that testing general relativity in the strong field limit. I should emphasize that these black holes have, since they are massive, the curvature in Planck units is very small around these black holes. But nevertheless, it's, imaging such black holes would provide good tests of general relativity, perhaps not of quantum effects near black holes. And then the last item is related to the ability to get very high energy particles in astrophysical environments, and I'll describe two of them, that accelerates high energy neutrinos and also produces very high energy gamma rays. That can be used to probe fundamental physics on scales that cannot be probed in the laboratory. So let me start with 21 centimeter cosmology. As I mentioned, that's a new probe of the initial conditions from inflation and the nature of the dark matter. Is it possible to dim a little bit the light? Because some of the... okay, great. So first, I would like to show an image from a Scientific American article that I wrote about 10 months ago. We basically, and that captures the idea here, we basically have an image of the universe when it was 0.4 million years old in the form of the cosmic microwave background. Around that time, half a million years after the Big Bang, the universe became transparent to the radiation that filled up the universe up to that point. And we obtained an image of this radiation across the sky, a two-dimensional image of the conditions in the universe at those early times. We have images of galaxies all the way up to redshift 6 or so. That's a billion years after the Big Bang. So the photo album that we have right now of the universe contains these images, a very early image and the images of the relatively nearby universe, but we are missing some pages in between. And part of the activity right now in cosmology is trying to get these missing pages in the photo album of the universe that we have. The general picture is that initially, during inflation, there were small density perturbations imprinted on the homogeneous background. And these grew with time. Regions that were denser than the average density of the universe became even denser with time due to the attractive nature of gravity. And mass was drawn into these regions from the voids that are now separating bound objects in the universe. So these regions eventually collapsed to make bound objects, as if they were part of a closed universe, because you can apply Birkhoff theorem around them. And they collapsed, like in a big crunch, to make an object. And that's these are the objects we see nowadays, the galaxies, the clusters of galaxies. And the mass to make these objects was drawn out of the large space that separates these objects. That's the big picture. What clues do we have about the composition of the universe? Actually, the best argument in favor of the universe being, the matter content in the universe being dominated by dark matter is not often emphasized either in textbooks or in the papers that you find on the subject. If we look at the microwave, this is a plot of the microwave background anisotropies. The amplitude of the anisotropies is a function of angular scale. L is the multiple index of on the sky. L of 200 corresponds to a scale of 1 degree on the sky. These are the different YLMs if you decompose the sky into YLMs. And as you go to higher Ls, of course, you consider you're considering smaller scales. And we can see that the power drops dramatically as you go to scales smaller than about a degree on the sky. And the reason for that is very simple. It's photon diffusion. So scales that were very small, fluctuations on those scales were smoothed out by the diffusion of photons around that time. This is called silk damping. And so there is evidence from existing data on the microwave background that indeed photon diffusion operated and suppressed the fluctuations in the radiation on small scales. Now, if the only component of matter in the universe was ordinary matter, baryonic matter, that couples to the radiation, then the baryonic matter would also show the same suppression. And these scales of roughly a degree or so correspond today to 200 megaparsecs. So there will be no way of making objects like galaxies whose mass is drawn out of regions smaller than 200 megaparsecs in the present-day universe. And all the objects that we see nowadays are made from matter that was assembled from regions that are much smaller than 200 megaparsecs. So the only way to preserve the small-scale structure, say, that was imprinted by inflation, is to have a component of matter that is not coupled to the radiation. A component that does not couple electromagnetically would preserve, would keep memory of these initial perturbations on small scales. And that's why you need, you really need dark matter. This is, in my view, the best evidence that we need dark matter. And of course, we realize that nowadays there is another component, which is presumably the vacuum energy density, but it does not participate in the structure formation in the universe. Now, the most popular candidate for the dark matter is a weakly interacting massive particle, and such a particle would cool to very low temperatures today due to the cosmic expansion since the time that it decoupled, and because of that it's called the cold dark matter. And the smallest scales of fragments that form in the universe, if indeed the dark matter is made of weakly interacting massive particles, are on the scale of a Jupiter mass, the mass of Jupiter, very small scales, 10 to the minus 3 of a solar mass. And we would expect clumps on these mass scales to exist in the dark matter sector. But of course, the gas cannot clump on these small scales, the ordinary gas. In fact, the very first objects to have formed in the universe in the gas that assembled gas into them were much more massive. They had about 100,000 solar masses. And the reason for that is gas pressure that suppressed the assembly of gas on small scales. The pressure gradient prevented gravity from assembling gas on small mass scales. So the very first objects to have formed in the universe at around the redshift of 20 or so were formed, as you can see here, this is a cut from a simulation that shows the molecular gas that forms in yellow at the intersection of the sheets and the filaments in this large-scale, well, this is small-scale structure back then. And these objects made the very first stars in the universe when it was only a few hundred million years old. So hundreds of millions of years after the Big Bang, that's when the first stars are thought to have emerged. Yes?
Can you explain just what the blue is?
Yes, so what you're seeing here is a cut from a simulation.
Okay.
And the contrast
illustrates the density, basically. So dark regions are high density regions. And the density is the density of the gaps. We could have shown a plot that shows the density of the dark matter, and the difference is, of course, the small-scale structure dark matter exhibits, but the gas cannot really... The gas is smoothing out the small-scale structure by pressure.
What's the scale of that?
We are talking about tens of parsecs here, smaller than the size of the core of the Milky Way galaxy, for example. Now, before the very first stars were formed, hydrogen filled up the universe. That's at the rate of 1,000, 0.4 million years after the Big Bang. That's when neutral hydrogen formed in the universe out of the free electrons and protons, when the temperature dropped below a few thousand degrees Kelvin. And we are used to thinking about the hydrogen atom, the simplest atom, as having just a simple ground state. But in fact, the ground state is split depending on the orientation of the spin of the electron relative to the spin of the proton. If the two are aligned, you get a slightly higher energy level than if the two are oppositely aligned. And the transition between these two levels corresponds to a photon with a wavelength of 21 centimeters, or a frequency of 1.4 gigahertz. This was predicted back in 1944 and observed by Purcell at Harvard in 1951. This transition was used a lot in astronomy, but not so much in cosmology. In this context, one usually defines the so-called spin temperature, which is just appearing in the Boltzmann factor that specifies how the fraction of atoms that are excited. So the number density of atoms in the excited state relative to the true ground state is related to a spin degeneracy factor, which is just 3, and then times an exponential Boltzmann factor, which has the energy separation between the levels, which is a 7% of a degree Kelvin, a very small energy separation, divided by some temperature, which we call the spin temperature. So the spin temperature simply expresses what is the relative population of the two levels. Not assuming, this is a definition of the spin temperature.
Right, but this if time transition is very slow, right? I mean,
if it's in thermal equilibrium, this temperature will be equal to the gas kinetic temperature. But if it's not, then the meaning of the spin temperature is just the logarithm of this ratio. You invert the equation, and that's the meaning of the spin temperature. It's not assuming that it's equal. Okay?
It doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have, so I'll explain it right away, actually. The excitation rate... atoms can be excited by atomic collisions or by interaction with the microwave background. And atomic collisions will try to couple the spin temperature to the gas kinetic temperature. So if you let them operate and they dominate, then the spin temperature will equilibrate with the gas kinetic temperature in thermal equilibrium. But the coupling to the microwave background tries to couple the spin temperature to the microwave background temperature. And the point is that the gas kinetic temperature is not necessarily the microwave background temperature, as I will describe in a minute.
So in fact, what happens is that the microwave background temperature equals the gas temperature down to a redshift of about 200 or so. And then the gas starts to cool faster than the microwave background temperature because the gas is non-relativistic. What keeps the two temperatures together is the residual fraction of free electrons left over from cosmological recombination. And that keeps the two temperatures coupled through Thomson scattering down to a redshift of 200 or a time of 500 million years, 50 million years. And then after that, the gas decouples from the microwave background. It cools like 1 plus z squared, like the redshift squared, and then it cools below the microwave background temperature. And the spin temperature initially is coupled to the gas temperature, but then eventually gets coupled back to the microwave background temperature, so it interpolates between the two temperatures. And you can see it more clearly here. The black line is the microwave background temperature, which goes like 1 plus z as a function of redshift. And then the gas temperature starts to decline below that at a redshift below 200. and then the spin temperature interpolates between the two. So one can do the atomic physics and try to figure out what kind of fluctuations in the 21 centimeter brightness would there be on the sky. The idea is that the gas is cooler than the microwave background, the temperature is lower than the microwave background at these redshifts, redshifts between, let's say, 20 or 30 and redshift of 200. And in this window, regions in the sky that will have more gas in them will absorb the microwave background more than regions that have less gas. So you would expect some variation in the brightness temperature of the 21 centimeter sky due to the clumpiness of the gas. And that's what we calculated in a paper that we published in Physical Review Letters in 2004. The anisotropies, the level of fluctuations you would expect in the 21 centimeter brightness as a function of the multiple index, the same YLM decomposition of the sky. Just to remind you, L of 200 is 1 degree, L of 1,000,000 is an arc second on the sky. So in fact, the peak in this power spectrum is on tiny scales, scales of arc seconds on the sky, that correspond to the genes, the scale over which the gas pressure starts to play a role, and then you get no clumpiness in the gas on smaller scales. So that's why you get a decline in the power on scales smaller than that due to gas pressure. But L up at which this power spectrum peaks is far greater than L of 200 that we saw for the microwave background. And that's simply because the microwave background suffers from photon diffusion, as I mentioned, while this radiation, the fluctuations in this radiation, the 21 centimeter line, they just map the gas distribution down to the scales where the gas clumps. So you can actually probe the initial conditions from inflation on much smaller scales than the microwave background can give you. And you can estimate the number of independent patches in the sky, in the universe that you can probe with a 21 centimeter line in principle. There are about 10 to the 16 independent patches that are accessible in principle, compared to about 10 to the 7 that you can get from the microwave background anisotropies. And the reason for that is that the microwave background anisotropies are two-dimensional. They come from a surface, while the 21 centimeter fluctuations are three-dimensional. You are looking at a resonant line, and the wavelength that you observe is the 21 centimeter wavelength times 1 plus z. So by looking at different wavelengths, you are slicing the universe at different redshifts. And therefore, you get also a three-dimensional map, not just a two-dimensional map on the sky. You can map the hydrogen distribution in three dimensions. And you get many more independent patches down to tiny scales that in principle can allow you to probe the initial conditions from inflation with much better statistics. There is no other data set. This is the biggest data set that in principle exists on the sky. So here is the big picture of what the theorists believe may have happened. We haven't yet observed it. At around the redshift of 1,000 or so, that's when the microwave background fluctuations were produced. That's the image that we have, for example, from WMAP. And then there were the dark ages, during which the universe just expanded, the microwave background cooled, and that we cannot really probe very well. And then at around the redshift of 200, the gas started to cool more rapidly than the microwave background. And then we can see the 21 centimeter line in absorption. And then around redshift 20 or so, that's when the first sources of light started forming, the first stars, the first galaxies. And these sources of light heated up the gas and increased its temperature above the microwave background temperature. So after that process ended, the gas appeared in emission rather than in absorption. And you can see here cuts from simulations that show the 21 centimeter brightness. So at early times, this is 200 million years after the Big Bang. The wavelength corresponding to that is 4.1 meters. So it's 21 centimeters times 1 plus z. At this time, you can see only the density inhomogeneity is imprinting brightness fluctuations. That is true also 290 million years after the Big Bang, and then 370 million years, that's when the very first objects form, you can see here. And then the red regions are regions that are ionized by the radiation from the galaxies. So the galaxies produce ultraviolet radiation that breaks the hydrogen into free electrons and protons. And that happens around the locations of these very first galaxies. So you get these cavities in the hydrogen distribution, and the radiation from the galaxies is basically excavating into the hydrogen, and it's just like a first-order phase transition. You have these galaxies that are just like nucleation sites, and you convert the neutral gas into an ionized gas by having these bubbles grow and eventually overlap.
And there are other sources of noise at that level of structure.
So I will talk about that. That's a very good question. So I will get to that maybe in a couple of slides. The general idea is that we are one is hoping to slice the universe at different redshifts by observing slightly different wavelengths. And you want to slice the universe at wavelength separation such that will correspond to the characteristic size of these bubbles that form after the first galaxies. So you can actually see how the universe gets ionized, the process of reionization of the universe. But you can also extend this study to the epoch before the first galaxies form, and from that probe the initial conditions from inflation. So by now there are quite a number of studies that use numerical simulations.
You can see here on the left the bubble structure in the hydrogen distribution. These are the regions that are ionized by galaxies that appear dark, and the regions that are still neutral appear red or yellow. What you see on the right-hand panel is the 21 centimeter brightness, a one-dimensional map as a function of redshift, going down in redshift in this direction. You can see how the bubbles initially are rare, and eventually they overlap and they make up a bigger fraction of the volume, eventually making the entire universe ionized by a redshift of 6 or so. So let me show you one of these simulations. You can see here how the bubbles grow and eventually fill up the entire volume. One way to get after the initial conditions from inflation, even after the bubbles form, is by using peculiar velocities. Imagine a region that is denser than the mean in the universe. The way by which it became denser is that there was velocity, peculiar velocity of matter that fell into that region. So if we imagine a density inhomogeneity delta, such that the density in this region is larger than the mean density of the universe by 1 plus delta, then there are two effects that one should consider. The brightness temperature of the 21 centimeter line is proportional to the optical depth in this line. And the optical depth should increase in the region that is overdense because there is more density of hydrogen in that region. But at the same time, the optical depth is also related to the path length over which the photons that we are looking at interacted with hydrogen atoms. And if there is a velocity gradient in the medium, then the path length is smaller the bigger this velocity gradient is, because eventually you run out of the resonance of the line due to the velocity gradient, the Doppler effect. Atoms simply shift out of resonance across a certain length scale. Now, this velocity gradient is just the Hubble parameter. In an expanding universe, the velocity of a source relative to an observer is changing with distance by the Hubble parameter. But then if the region is overdense, there would be a correction to that, which is related to the overdensity delta. So there are two factors that change the optical depth. One is the increase in the density, and the second is the change in the Hubble parameter. But that velocity contribution makes the power spectrum not isotropic, because if you imagine the line of sight to the observer as being along this vector here, and you Fourier decompose the density field into K modes so that you consider a particular K mode in some direction, and there is an angle theta between the line of sight and the vector, then there are two factors of cosine theta that enter. One is because the Doppler effect is sensitive to the radial velocity, the velocity along the line of sight, so there is one factor of cosine theta. And then the second one comes because we have the radial derivative of the radial velocity component. So altogether, there are two factors of cosine theta, and you get a dependence on the angle of the K vector in the power spectrum. So if we measure the power spectrum and we can measure this angular dependence, then we can infer the peculiar velocity field at those redshifts. And that peculiar velocity is induced purely by gravity. So in principle, it allows us to separate the effect of the initial conditions that came from inflation from all other sources of fluctuations. The other sources of fluctuations are many, but they are all isotropic. There is no preferred direction in the universe. So this is a nice method of separating the peculiar velocity effect. There are by now several experiments that are aiming at detecting these 21 centimeter anisotropies. The one that we are involved in is called the Murchison-Whitefield Array. Its location is in Western Australia. It was Mellura, but then the price of gold rose, and the Australian government decided to dig, to open up some mines that were in the vicinity of Mellura, so that there is actually a train that will be passing nearby that would cause a problem for this experiment. And so as a result, they moved it even to a more remote area. Well, the only problem is that some of the sites where you might want to put your arrays are holy to the aboriginals. And there is no map that says which site is holy, so they have to go by trial and error. The other experiment, big experiment, so this experiment is actually funded, fully funded. We received $5 million from NSF, and also $5 million from the Australian government, and some additional funds. So it's fully funded, and it will happen. And the first data will probably come out within a few years from now. The other experiment is LOFAR, which for political reasons is done in the Netherlands. And the Dutch government allocated a large amount of money under one condition, that the experiment will be done in the Netherlands. And the problem with that, as you already noticed, we are talking about very low frequencies. Turns out that these frequencies correspond to the same frequencies that TV and radio broadcasting is operating in. And so putting such an experiment in Europe is not a great idea. But yes, at least it's
not maybe worth it.
Right. Then there is another very good site, actually, in China that is being used by another collaboration, but is not well funded, and it doesn't have quite the same quality of instruments and also people as the other experiments. And there is a small experiment called PAPER by Berkeley, another attempt to use a telescope in India, and so far they were able to image the electric poles that are nearby. They were not able to see the distant universe. And in fact, Weili Pan gave a talk where he said that now, he said, we will show you an image, an optical image of the source, that and he showed an electric pole. and then the futuristic, in hopefully a couple of decades or so, the square kilometer array will also be able to probe 21 centimeter from high redshift. Just to give you an impression, even though this is a center for theoretical physics, I want to show you how these experiments look like. And what you can see are the antennas, the dipole antennas. They resemble the antennas that you buy for a television in radio shape. I mean, they are basically the same technology, very simple type of hardware, but you just need a large number of them. So we're talking about 500 tiles, each of which contains 16 dipole antennas. So about 7,000 antennas altogether in the first experiment, the Murchison wide field array, and then perhaps a factor of increase, a factor of 10 increase in the number of antennas in a subsequent experiment. And these arrays of antennas will be spread across a 1.5 kilometer area and will reach a resolution of a few arc minutes. The frequency coverage is 80 to 300 megahertz. And you can see here the early deployment of these antennas. The main challenge, and that addresses your question, is the foreground. There is, of course, interference with radio and TV broadcasting, but that you can attempt to avoid by going to remote sites or filtering out the known stations. The real problem is the galactic synchrotron foreground. It's actually 4 to 5 orders of magnitude brighter than the signal that one is searching for. And nevertheless, we are hopeful that we can pick out the signal. And the reason for that, based on calculations, is that the synchrotron emission from galaxies has a smooth dependence on frequency, while the signal that comes from the universe is fluctuating as a function of frequency, because every frequency corresponds to a different cut through the universe, a different redshift. So by changing slightly the frequency, one is able, and subtracting two images at the two frequencies, you can get rid of the smooth component. You can fit it out by a smooth polynomial. And then you are left only with the fluctuating component, which presumably comes from high redshifts. And when you go through the numbers, it looks like this is doable. And here is an illustration. The solid line at the top, the black line, is the signal that one expects, the power spectrum, as a function of a wave number in units of megaparsecs to the minus one. And these are the sensitivities of the various experiments. So MWA here is in blue. You can see that the sensitivity is very good. The signal should be detected with a high statistical significance. Of course, this is just the statistical significance of detecting the power spectrum. The first generation of experiments will not really image the sky. We will not be able to say that here is a bubble and here is not a bubble. We will just be able to say that there is some power in the fluctuations of the 21 centimeter with a relatively high confidence. That's right. So that's the first generation of experiments will go after the bubbles for two reasons. One is that this later epoch, when the galaxies excavated, sent out UV photons that ionized bubbles in the universe, corresponds to higher frequencies. The synchrotron foreground from the galaxy goes like wavelength to the 2.6 power, or frequency to the minus 2.6 power. So it means that at high frequencies, you can much more easily get rid of it than at low frequencies. So it's much easier to detect the signal at low redshifts than at higher frequencies. Okay, and that's why they are first looking at the low redshift epoch. The second thing is that the signal is bigger, because when you have an ionized bubble, then the contrast is unity. You have a region where there is a cavity in hydrogen, and next to it, a neutral region. While density and homogeneity is on these large scales, tens of megaparsecs, have fluctuations that are less than unity. And so you gain on both grounds. But in fact, we have put out the proposals to extend this first generation experiment and go into the epoch of where fluctuations were not affected by astrophysics, but just can just be used to map the conditions. But one has to do things in steps. I mean, since these experiments are just starting now, one should go after the easy part first. And you can see here the interference from terrestrial radio emission. You can see what happens near Sydney, Australia, and then as you go to a more remote area, there are still peaks. I mean, each of these lines is a radio station, and then near Melura, the previous location, previous site, there are not many stations left.
So what are the final scales that you expect to?
A few years from now, there should be results coming. Maybe two or three years. In fact, the idea that we suffer from galactic interference from our own civilization led us to consider what sensitivity these experiments might have to extraterrestrials, similar to ours. So you can imagine just taking the MWA and placing it at a distance from the Earth. How far away from the Earth will we be able to still pick up the radio signals that we are producing? And it turns out that you can go out to tens of light years. So if you take the MWA, it will be sensitive to civilizations similar to ours, out to 50 light years. And the interesting thing is that we have been broadcasting for 50 years. So someone out there, if they are similar to us, they should know about us, which is not necessarily a good thing. We were not careful, especially during the Cold War with Russia. There was a lot of power being transmitted in the defense system against ballistic missiles.
Excuse me?
Yes?
Is it take time for them to get us a signal that they have received though?
Sorry?
Does it take more years for them to signal back that they have received something?
Well, it takes, of course, twice the distance. Well, for them to know about us, it's the distance the vibrates to the planet. Right. And so it will take decades, yes. But then, given the fact that we transmit most of our power in the by military radars, I would be very worried if these experiments, for example, detected a signal coming out from space, because most likely it comes from a militant civilization, not from a peaceful one. Peaceful civilizations use cables or digital but only those that really want to use radars for military purposes are bright, as far as I know. Coming back to science, there is actually hope to detect 21 centimeters centimeter radiation also after the universe got ionized. And that we realized only this summer in a couple of papers that we wrote with Stuart Wyatt in August and September. Turns out that the universe, even after the universe gets fully ionized, it's not really fully ionized. We know about systems that contain hydrogen in the universe. These are called damped Lyman alpha systems. You can think about them as gas-rich galaxies, basically pockets of dense gas that is dense enough for it not to be influenced by the ionizing background that is impinging on these pockets. The recombination rate within these dense pockets is large enough to compensate for any ionization. And so it turns out that there is a few percent of the baryons in the universe at all redshifts seems to reside in these kinds of pockets. Dense environments, galactic environments. And you can go after the 21 centimeter emission from these gaseous systems. Turns out that the signal is somewhat weaker because only a few percent of the baryons are now neutral. But at the same time, as I mentioned before, the foreground, the noise, goes like the wavelength to the 2.6 power, or like the redshift to the 2.6 power. So if you go to low redshifts, in fact, even though the signal is down, the noise is also down significantly. And it turns out in a paper that we wrote that the signal is as detectable at a redshift of 3 as it is at a redshift of 7 or 8 from the epoch of reionization. So in fact, these experiments will be sensitive to the residual fraction of neutral gas left over in the universe, even at low redshifts. And why is that important? That's important because one can go after the acoustic oscillations. I promised not to speak much about the dark energy, but I have to mention the acoustic oscillations. So the idea here is that at time t equals zero, imagine dropping a pin in the universe, basically generating a perturbation at a point. And then that produces a sound wave that propagates out at the speed of sound, which is the speed of light divided by the square root of 3. So there is this sound horizon out to which points know about the perturbation that was introduced at the center. And so there are correlations in the fluctuations on scales within the sound horizon. And you can take the Fourier transform of this cavity that you have, the sound horizon, and you get a fundamental mode that has a wavelength that fits exactly into this region, and you can have the higher multiples of that.
And these are called acoustic oscillations. So in fact, you would expect them to exist in the 21 centimeter power spectrum, these oscillations. We see them in the microwave background. We also see them in the distribution of galaxies at low redshifts. But this is, for example, what you might see if you were to image the power spectrum at redshifts of order 100 or several tens at early times when there were no galaxies around. And you can also calculate the detectability of these oscillations in the power spectrum at low redshifts, and that's what we did recently. And it turns out that you can measure the location, the K value, the wave number of the acoustic oscillations to a very high precision, to a level of a percent or so. No, because what you care about is not the amplitude so much as the scale.
Detectability depends on the amplitude.
Right, so that's what we calculated. We calculated the amplitude using simulations that fit all the other observables of damp-flammable and absorbers. And we actually simulated what an observation by a future radio telescope might show. And it turns out that you can localize the acoustic wave number to a very high precision, to a level of a few percent with such a dedicated array of low frequency dipoles. So this is another method for actually probing the acoustic oscillations that was not advertised before. And it's much less expensive than doing surveys of galaxies or supernova, type 1a supernova. And this method actually goes to higher redshifts, so all the way from redshift 1 up to redshift 15 or so. So it allows you to probe the contribution of the vacuum energy density to the mass budget of the universe at the last 98% of the cosmic history of the universe. You can see here the precision in pinning down the value of the wave number of acoustic oscillations. It reaches a percent or so within some redshift windows for the existing or the future experiments that I mentioned before. So let me move on to describe the other topics. I don't have much time, so I'll focus mainly on the black hole topic. So in fact, the main way by which people were able to probe the hydrogen in the early universe was using quasars. You can see here the absorption by neutral hydrogen in the spectrum of quasars at different redshifts. The redshift is illustrated by the trough, the place where this absorption starts. And the claim is that there is some good evidence that the neutral hydrogen was more abundant above redshift 6. So it means that reionization probably completed around the redshift 6 or 7. So that brings me to the topic of black holes. And here the idea is to image black holes. And the biggest black hole on the sky is actually the black hole at the center of our galaxy, Sagittarius A star. This is an image of all the stars in the center of our galaxy with a very large telescope. And when you focus, when you zoom in around the galactic center, this is a snapshot of the stars near the galactic center. And this snapshot was taken in 1992. And since then, people have taken more and more snapshots. And what they found, if they put them on a movie, they find that the stars are actually moving around the black hole at a very high speed. The nearest star in this image is actually this one. And it completed its orbit, actually, this year in June. There was a conference dedicated to this, the completion of its orbit in Germany. And the velocity by which the star is moving around the center is about 5,000 kilometers per second at closest approach. So we have very good evidence for a dark object, and we can actually measure its mass from all fitting Keplerian orbits for these stars. And we can find that the centroid of the orbits, the center of gravity, is the same for all the orbits. And there is very little emission from the direction of the black hole. It's about 100 astronomical units, 10 to the 15 centimeters. That's the closest approach, which is roughly the size of the solar system. And the black hole has a mass of about 4 million solar masses.
How tightly constrained is the orbit? You know, are we going to be able to say, well, if we wait another 200 years, astronomers are going to be able to sit there and watch it actually get sucked in?
No, it will not. The time scale for that is very long. What you can hope to do is perhaps get very precise measurements of the orbits and look for general twisting effects. So there was actually a paper just a few days ago by people Weir talking about that. People talked about that a couple of years ago. I wrote a paper about it. So you can hope to test gravity, perhaps measure post-Newtonian parameters, and perhaps even measure the spin of the black hole if there is a good enough orbit. It's close.
But isn't that better than doing it in the solar system?
Yes, it is. Well, at this time it's not, but it could become better. So this orbit of SO2, the closest star, comes back every 10 years. And the technology is improving every 10 years, so there could be a PhD student working on this orbit every 10 years, using better and better and comparing notes to the previous PhDs. But this will continue for a long time. There are another development in this context is that there were about 10 stars discovered in the halo of the Milky Way, which have velocities of order 1,000 kilometers per second in excess of the escape speed from the Milky Way. So these stars are on their way out of the Milky Way, and the most plausible explanation is that they result, these are stars that were originally in a binary with another star, and then the binary came close enough to the black hole so that one of the stars was kicked out, and while the other became more tightly bound to the black hole. This is the most plausible mechanism, but there are other ways of doing that. For example, if you have a second black hole, then the two black holes, the combined system, acts as a pinball. I mean, whenever a star crosses it, they can get ejected with high speed. And then a variant of that is that the scattering was of stars off stellar mass black holes, which are expected to be segregated around the black hole, the supermassive black hole. So there are various mechanisms by which you can get, but all of them are linking these very high velocity stars that were discovered over the past few years with the black hole at the center of our galaxy.
So the trajectories of those go back to the center of the galaxy?
Yes, so they're all consistent, with, except for one, which people believe may have come from a satellite galaxy in the Milky Way halo, but all the others, all the nine or so, are directed in the right way.
But asymmetric explosions in a simple binary, like if you had a supernova in a simple binary, it could...
No, you cannot get, because the highest velocity you can get from a binary star system is the escape speed from the surface of one of the stars, and that's only 500 kilometers per second. And these velocities are measured actually in the halo, so these stars were already decelerated from the way out. In order to eject a star from the Milky Way, we need to expel it from the center of our galaxy with at least 800 kilometers per second, if we just reach the halo. And this process happens roughly once per million years in our galaxy. And we should expect that such stars to come from the nearest neighbor to the Milky Way, which is the Andromeda Galaxy. So in fact, I had a summer student that worked on that and made some predictions. We should expect about 1,000 such stars in the Milky Way halo that came from Andromeda.
So how about from Milky Way itself?
Well, we should expect also a large number from the Milky Way itself. Most of the stars are low mass, but then it's like finding a needle in a haystack, because there are lots of low mass stars in the halo, and that's why the only stars that are found so far have a mass of a few solar masses, because then you can separate them from the rest of the population of stars, but there should be many more of them.
And you expect more from the Milky Way than from Andromeda?
More from the Milky Way, but the difference is those from Andromeda are in the direction of Andromeda.
Okay.
So you can tell the difference that they're approaching us. Sagittarius A star, the black hole in the galactic center, is the biggest one on the sky. There are bigger black holes in the universe, but they are much farther out. And therefore, if we want to image a black hole ever, then this would be the best candidate. So why do we expect there to be a mission from the vicinity of the black hole? Well, in fact, people have detected infrared emission. And this black hole region was actually first recognized as a radio source. So we know that there is emission from a gas that is falling onto the black hole. we also see variability in this emission, and that argues for some hotspot in the accreting gas, and the hotspots are perhaps orbiting around, and we see modulation of flux. And if you just want to get a sense of the scales in the system, the innermost stable circular orbit around the Schwarzschild black hole has a radius of 30 micro arc seconds. We hardly resolve 0.1 arc seconds with the best telescopes right now, but here we're talking about 30 micro arc seconds. And the orbital time is about half an hour. That's convenient. How can we actually resolve these scales? Well, the idea is that if there is a hotspot that is orbiting the black hole, for example, you can look for a change in the centroid of the image, because the hotspot is on, at some time it's on one side of the black hole, and at another time it's on the other side. So the centroid of the image will move back and forth, and there is actually an experiment after we did some calculations on this with Avery Broderick. There is an experiment planned for the Very Large Telescope called Gravity that will attempt to monitor centroid motion at the level of tens of micro arc second. This is being developed by Reinhard Genzel, and it's the hope is that it will be able to resolve these centroid motions. There is also a possibility of imaging the black hole at millimeter wavelengths in the radio. Below a millimeter, you can actually look all the way down to the black hole. So let me show you what the theorist version of what they might see looks like. So this is a hotspot orbiting a Schwarzschild black hole. And as it moves around, there is a secondary image that is forming. As you can see, there are these nice arcs because of gravitational lensing. And so in principle, if you could image the black hole in real time, you would see a hotspot moving around and you would see the lensed images. But you don't need to actually resolve it. You can actually just measure the flux as a function of time, and there would be a variation of the flux and also of the polarized flux that is characterized by generativistic effects near the black hole. So this could serve as a laboratory for testing general relativity. Since I mentioned the Andromeda galaxy, I cannot avoid mentioning also the fact that we will merge with the Andromeda galaxy in the not so distant future. So people think about it as very far into the future, but it turns out that it's only 5 billion years that it will take before we collide with Andromeda galaxy. The merger product, why is this important, is because the merger product is the only cosmological object that will be visible to us in the future, for future astronomers, in about 100 billion years. Because the universe is accelerating, all the other objects in the universe, all the other sources, will exit from our horizon within 100 billion years. And the only source that we will be able to see in the night sky will be the merger product of the Milky Way and Andromeda. So we better make some predictions about what astronomy will be like in 100 billion years. Because then people will spend a lot of time just checking and testing these predictions. The interesting question is, how long will it take before the Andromeda galaxy will collide with the Milky Way? We did the calculation, and it looks like it will take place during the lifetime of the Sun, within the next 5 billion years, and the night sky will obviously change. So let me show you a results from a simulation that we have done with TJ Cox, and I guess this is, yeah, you've read. So let me show you what it looks like. Well, what you see is the stars and the gas. I have a problem with the size of the screen right now. Okay, so you can see how, the gas realizes eventually and makes a single galaxy. So these are the cores of the two galaxies.
And it turns out that even though they have some transverse speed right now, this transverse velocity gets damped by the dynamical friction on the background halo. And the two galaxies eventually plunge into each other and make an elliptical galaxy, something that looks more like a spheroid of stars. And that will be what I term the Milkomeda galaxy, Milky Way and Andromeda. We simply had this phrase, the Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxies, in the paper many times. So I tried to save space, and I asked my wife whether she thinks Milkomeda is a good name, and she said, well, it sounds okay to me, neutral. And then it turned out, I checked on Google, there was nothing mentioned on such a name, and then after our paper was posted, by now there is even a website that is called Milkomeda, only 2 months later. So it became a fashionable name. Now I cannot stop it. So, in fact, we see lots of galaxies interacting and colliding in the universe. And if each galaxy contains a black hole, as seems to be the case when you look at nearby galaxies, then indeed what you would get are black hole binaries that eventually become very tight due to friction on the background stars. And, of course, at the end, the process is driven by the emission of gravity waves. And one of the interesting recent developments in this context, over the past 2 years, people were able to simulate the emission of gravity waves all the way to the plunge and get the gravitational wave pattern. And you must have heard about this quite a bit. In fact, let me show you a simulation from one of the groups by Joan Centrella from NASA. You can see the two black holes coming together. And what she shows here is some derivative of the metric that illustrates how the gravity waves are being emitted for a time-dependent metric. And eventually, when the two black holes come very close, the emission is much more powerful. And one of the results, the important results of these kinds of simulations, has to do with the excess momentum that is given to the remnant black hole. During the final plunge, if the two black holes do not have the same mass, one of the black holes falls, the light one falls into the more massive ones and emits gravitational waves in a particular direction due to relativistic beaming. And as a result, the remnant gets kicked in the opposite direction by momentum conservation. And this kick is important for astrophysical purposes. What you see here is the sensitivity of the future LISA mission to such mergers. These are, for example, 10 to the, these are different black hole masses, 10 to the 5 solar masses, 10 to the 6, and 10 to the 7 solar mass binaries. They start here and eventually they coalesce with a signal that is many orders of magnitude above the sensitivity of LISA. So we should be able, within the next, whenever LISA gets funded, we should be able to see these events. And one of the interesting outcomes of these kicks that I mentioned is that when two black holes come together, they get kicked from the center of a galaxy. And the kick velocity could be a few hundred kilometers per second. And so the black hole remnant will be displaced significantly from the center of a galaxy. If there is an accretion disk around the black hole binary to start from, the accretion disk will be carried with the black hole remnant. And that was published in a paper that I put out just a few months ago in PRL, simply because the gas around the black hole in this disk is orbiting at the speed that approaches the speed of light close to the black hole. And the kick velocity is much less than the speed of light. So as far as the gas is concerned, the gas is orbiting many, many times as the black hole slowly drifts away from the center of the galaxy. Yes? Okay.
So, in fact, I will not have time to discuss the last item, which is
accelerating neutrinos and high-energy gamma rays, producing high-energy gamma rays in cosmic shocks. But if you have any questions about that, I'll be glad to address them. Thank you.
maybe I'll just jump to the conclusion so you can see what I make could have described in this talk. So the three topics, one is the 21 centimeter that provides the richest data set on the initial conditions of the universe. The second is the ability to image supermassive black holes. And the last one, they didn't have a chance to talk about.
Yeah, I guess I had so about the 21 centimeter stuff. So looking far ahead, what kind of ideal experiment are people thinking about, like to reduce the radio noise, or to think about going in space with these?
Well, yes. So there are several fronts that one can think about. One is to still do it on the ground and just improve the sensitivity to low frequencies so that we get to higher redshifts than the ones that are being accessed with the first generation of satellites. And so, we are thinking about that, how to make experiments that improve the epoch before the first galaxies form. The one problem is, of course, that the ionosphere of the Earth does not allow you to go to arbitrarily low frequencies, because it cuts off, actually, you can't see the universe below 20 megahertz or so. And that corresponds to high redshifts approaching 100 or so. So if you ever want to get to very high redshifts, you might prefer to do so on the moon, for example. And NASA is very eager now to develop science programs for the moon. So we did put out a proposal just recently to develop or design a possible low-frequency observatory on the moon. All you need is just the wires, wire antennas that will mimic these dipoles and will be sensitive to very long wavelengths. And since there is no ionosphere on the moon, you can go to arbitrarily long wavelengths. And so that's another interesting frontier. But we're talking just about starting to develop the concept of the observers. It may take a long while before it's realized. But this entire field is at its infancy, because the very first observatories will come into place within a couple of years. And the main reason it was not done before, I mean, you may wonder, I mean, these radio antennas are very simple-minded, that they existed for several decades, right? And the reason it was not done is because there is a huge amount of information that comes through. And only now modern computers allow you to process the information in real time. And most of the data is thrown out. You cannot store it. But the little bit of data that you store, I mean, you can filter out only with present-day computers. And it was not possible 20 years ago. So we shall see. Hopefully, there will be a demonstration that this is doable, like we are expecting. And then, of course, more money will be put into this. I see it as the future of CMB research. Many of the observers that do CMB observations now do not realize it, because they are too occupied with existing projects, trying to measure the Smyrnyi-Absudovich effects mostly. But the way I see it is that this will be a richer data set and will be a source of activity for many decades, because it can always improve and perhaps grow smaller scales and higher redshifts and get a much better handle on the initial conditions of manipulation.
Yes, so that was the new aspect. So what kind of parameter constraint that people are...
So in the paper that we put with Matthias in 2004, we considered the various... So you can, for example, look at deviations of the power spectrum from scale invariant to a very high precision, or tracing a small amount of the dark matter in the form of neutrinos, or looking for non-Gaussianity. And since you have many more independent... It all depends on how many independent patches you have. Because your Poisson precision goes like 1 over the square root of n, the number of independent patches, and in principle you can improve the CMB constraints by all on all of these. So it all depends on how sensitive is the observer in terms of how many patches, independent patches you can put. But at least there is this data set. I mean, this is something to look forward to. If you think about the CMB, then you have a limited data set falling down to L of a few hundred, maybe a thousand. Yes?
Yeah, You referred many times to the initial condition. Again, you referred. I'm not sure I understand that. Are you talking about density fluctuations in the dark matter that you're picking up from the 21 centimeter line? Is that there?
Well, what you're doing with the 21 centimeter line is you're mapping the hydrogen. Okay?
Yeah,
so whatever the hydrogen does, you're seeing. Because in the early epoch, if there is more hydrogen in one direction, you get more absorption, for example, against the CMB background. In the late epoch, when the hydrogen emits instead of absorbing, you see more intensity of emission in the regions that are dense. Okay, so you are mapping the hydrogen.
Yes.
Now, the hydrogen at early times simply follows the gravitational potential wells of the dark matter. And it is able to follow it down to a very small scales, as I mentioned, 10 to the 5 solar masses.
So
the dark matter clamps down to a Jupiter mass, but the gas is able to follow it down to
So that's the part I don't totally understand. There must be some astrophysics in how the hydrogen...
No.
Are you saying it's completely...
It's a fluid. The hydrogen is a fluid, a gas, that responds to gravity, right? So it clumps on scales down to which the pressure is not important. At some point, the pressure starts to resist the force of gravity. That happens on the so-called Jeans length, or mass scale of all the 10 to the 5 solar mass. Below that, the gas cannot really fragment or clump. But on scales bigger than that, it just follows the dark matter.
But is it always in equilibrium?
It's not in equilibrium.
There is some streaming?
There is some streaming, yes.
So there is some astrophysics going
on? No, not astrophysics.
Whatever you want to call it. There's
something
physics. Analogous to a camera.
You can think about the dark matter as the dark matter is also a fluid. The dark matter
is the transfer function that's going in here.
The only difference between the dark matter and the gas is that the pressure of the dark matter is lower than the pressure of the gas. That's all. Both of them are fluids. The dark matter is collisionless fluid, right? But it follows gravity. The dark matter is very cold, and it follows gravity. There is a small scale of order Jupiter mass below which the dark matter cannot be regarded as a cold fluid because the running speeds of the wheels, the weakly interacting mass particles, smooth out fluctuations on scales smaller than a Jupiter mass. The gas has a similar concept, which is called the Jeans length, which is the smoothing length. But that scale is bigger. It's not a Jupiter mass, it's 10 to the 5 solar mass. On scales bigger than that, pressure is unimportant, and the gas follows exactly the same trajectories as the dark matter. Starting from slightly different initial conditions, because the gas, you have to remember, the gas was released at a redshift of 1,000. Prior to that, it was coupled to the macro effect. So it started at a redshift of 1,000, slightly offset from the dark matter, which never coupled to the macro effect. Other than that, the gas, you can regard it as following the dark matter, basically. So it's a perfect trace. Now, at low redshifts below 20 or so, the gas starts to, once you make the first stars, the first galaxies, the stars ionize the gas and create these cavities in the neutral gas. So you start to get astrophysical effects there. But before the first stars, the first galaxies form, the gas is a perfect tracer. So just using atomic physics and physics as we know it, you can map reliably the initial conditions, no ambiguity.
So I think we can move to the session explorability and thank Dapi again.